Peter is a gift to preachers and Sunday school teachers. He is a ready-made object lesson. He's the way you talk about the glaring failures of a particular congregation member without having to mention them by name. On the flip side, he's an aid to self-esteem. He is the standard of comparison by which all of us who are insecure in our faith, who regularly feel deficient in our resolve to live by that faith, who suffer from an overdeveloped awareness of our own inadequacies, might feel slightly better about ourselves. Peter's only trouble is that he is an extrovert. All of us who are introverts recognize this and are secretly delighted by it. Peter thinks out loud instead of pondering and brooding and calculating. Peter puts his hand up instead of waiting to see if someone else will speak up. Peter says what's on his mind instead of properly squirreling it away for 30 years, waiting for the right moment to pull it out and use it as evidence. The rest of them, I'm thinking, we're all introverts, bless their hearts. Thaddeus and Bartholomew are disciples too, but what do they say in all of the Gospels? Not a peep. The point is, as we introverts will tell you, that it is usually the extroverts who take the fall. James and John were there too on the mountain when Jesus was transfigured and Moses and Elijah appeared. What do you bet they were also thinking? Wouldn't it be nice to put up a few tents and just stay here? But it's Peter who speaks up. Bad idea, Jesus says. Phew, say James and John. When Jesus asks, who do people say that I am? And the disciples give him one-word answers. Elijah, John the Baptist, one of the prophets. We aren't told which of the disciples speak up. Could have been poor Thaddeus. But then Jesus goes to the heart of things. Who do you say that I am? And Peter is the first with his hand in the air. You are the Christ. Ah, man, thinks Thaddeus. I was going to say that in a minute. Here's where Jesus calls Peter the cornerstone of the church. And this is when the introverts, in delicious silent resentment, start thinking that the extroverts get all the praise and the attention. And then Jesus goes on to speak of his death, and Peter is the first to say what is on all of their hearts, "No, Lord." And the other 11 all envy him his ability to speak his feelings. Then Jesus says to Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And suddenly being an introvert doesn't seem so bad after all. So I'm saying, let's give a little shout out to the 11 who stayed in the boat. Surely by this point, they've been together long enough that when Peter steps down out of the boat, the rest of them have to be thinking, this will be interesting. And just because they didn't holler out, "Jesus, if it's you, tell me to come to you," didn't mean that they didn't love him less or want with any less intensity to know it was him and go to him. They weren't the sort who wore their love on their sleeve. But Peter was just exactly that sort. Biblical scholars, and by that I actually just mean me, categorize Jesus' walking on the water as one of the nifty miracles. It's not one of your raising of the dead, healing the sick, casting out of demons miracles of weighty import. It's more like turning the water into wine. It doesn't leave you awestruck or dumbfounded, just happy that someone thought to invite him. Jesus is to the lake as the chicken is to the road. He just wanted to get to the other side. "Hey, Jesus, want to ride across the lake?" "No, thanks. I'd rather walk." While changing the water into wine was nifty then and there, Jesus walking on the water was nifty only in retrospect. In the fourth watch of the night, far out in the middle of the lake, in the midst of a storm, seeing a figure walking towards them on the water was nifto-terrifying. But Peter, apparently unencumbered by the thought process, gets out of the boat. The secret to walking on the water, it seems, is not thinking too hard about it. Peter was doing just fine until that moment of clarity when it all registered. The wind, the waves, the laws of physics, which is when the problems started. Serious problems, like the serious problem of drowning. Until then, Peter was like a man at an Obama rally. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Oh, it isn't as though solid ground is anything more than a comforting and temporary illusion. When we thought the economy would hold us, then came along the fall of Lehman Brothers and AIG and the credit defaults and the final gasps of the auto industry, and it was all just water under our feet. And each of us, in our own experiences of grief, whatever those experiences are or have been, know exactly what it is to feel the ground give way. There we are with the tiny boat left behind, jostling in the waves receding behind us, and the shore too far ahead. Can there be a more apt image for that desperation that sometimes suddenly invades our lives? Maybe even we think that we can manage it, and for a time we do. And then reality forces itself in on us, and all we know is that overwhelming sense of our own utter powerlessness. Just like Peter in the middle of the lake, with the storm and the night descending and the water rising up. But it's not an exact metaphor. Peter wasn't thrown into the water. He, by his own choosing, stepped out of the boat. And it wasn't loss or grief or desperation that got him there. It was only love. Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you. At the close of the Gospel of John, Jesus and Peter speak together of love. They are on the beach. It is morning. Peter and the other disciples have again been out fishing through the night. They have come into the shore that morning to find the resurrected Christ making breakfast over a charcoal fire. And it hasn't been long at all since that night of horrors. And the memory of that night, especially for Peter, is still searingly fresh. How he betrayed his own best self. No, I don't know him, never heard of him, have nothing to do with that one called Jesus. And not just once, and not just twice, but three times he said it. And that morning, Jesus is not at all interested in reviewing what happened that night. Peter, Jesus says, do you love me? Rabbi, Peter says, you know I do. Feed my sheep. Twice more, the exchange will be repeated. Peter, son of John, do you love me? Rabbi, you know I love you. Say what we will about Peter, his impetuosity, sandaled foot in mouth, his tendency to act before thinking, his Joe Biden-like capacity for unedited speech. None of that matters. Not even the terrible betrayal matters. It doesn't mean a thing. The truth of Peter is his love for the Christ. Paul says, faith, hope, and love abide. But the greatest of these, greater than hope, greater even than faith, is love. For when hope failed him, and when his faith was weak, and when his faith would not even carry him across the water, love reached out and picked him up. When Peter saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus reached out his hand, caught him and said, "You little faith, why do you doubt?" A colleague I spoke to about this text recalls seeing a version of it acted out. And what she remembered most was the way in which the actor who played Jesus chose to speak these lines. There was, she said, in his voice, no remonstrance, but rather such a fondness, such bemused recognition, such familiarity, so that there was no sting in it, but pure kindness. Peter loved Jesus, and Jesus loved Peter. Here is the scene then. The boat in the near distance, the rolling water, the night sky, the froth of the storm, the figure of Jesus radiant from within with an encompassing peace, the figure of Peter shaking with the water running off of him. See it in your mind and then set all of that aside. And concentrate only on those two hands. The hand of Peter, cold, shaking, flailing wildly, and the hand of the Christ, steady, warm, sure. This is why it matters that ours is an incarnational faith. That God became one of us, walked among us, sat and spoke with us, slept and worked and ate, and knew hunger and loneliness, happiness and fear, despair and joy, just as we do. No abstraction, no philosophical speculations, no idea of God, but God who is near at hand. All that there is to know about God is all that there is to know about love. And all that there is to know about love is here in the hand of Peter, enfolded by the hand of Jesus. For God, says the psalmist, is not far off, and God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble. As though the whole of the universe, all of time and space, collapses and is distilled in this moment of equipoise, Jesus and Peter joined at the hand, balanced on top of the water. Let everything else stop. Here is love in these two hands in the middle of the night, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the lake, with nothing around. So may we, whatever our proclivities towards introversion or extroversion, be more like Peter. May it be said of us that our greatest fault was that we wore our love on our sleeve. May love fling us out before we have time to consider the consequences. And when the water rises, because the water will rise. May we be so secure in love that we will not be too proud or ashamed or afraid to cry out. And may we know the answer before we even ask, that God is for us and that God is even now coming towards us across the water, hand outstretched. Let it be so. Amen.